Thank you very much. Yeah. You don't have to applaud beforehand. You don't know that the talk's going to be any good. So the unofficial title of this talk is What Did I Do as a Graduate Student That Won Me the Nobel Prize? Right? I've become the poster child for women in STEM, but I've also become the poster child for grad students who hope that their PhD also lands them a Nobel Prize. So that's what this talk's about. It is about another talk, and usually, again, I give this talk more to laser people than to theoretical physicists, but I do try to point out that I think science is driven forward not just by fundamental or not just by applied, but the fact that we have both working together. So we didn't get the laser without understanding the linear interaction between light and matter. And when the laser came along, it brought along a different way that light and matter could interact, and we got to nonlinear optics. And when I tried in my PhD to do a high order nonlinear process, we got the laser intensity so high that again, it changed how light and matter interacted. I don't think we have a good name for it yet, which is why it's still just called high intensity laser physics. There is no theory in my talk, so I'm just gonna give you a 1 minute version of it. So linear optics is like linear anything else, but take Maxwell's equations and the displacement is linearly proportional to the electric field, or it's really the response of the material, which we give as polarization, is taken to be linearly proportional to the electric field. But that really is just the first order term of a Taylor expansion. And you get to nonlinear optics when the other terms show up in this Taylor expansion. But a Taylor expansion is only good if it converges. So at laser intensities, which are not SI units, I'm sorry, but watts per square centimeter, of around 10 to the 12 watts per square centimeter, the Taylor expansion breaks down. And the reason that it breaks down, well, there's a few reasons, but by 10 to the 13 watts per square centimeter, then the electric field of the light is the same as the electric field binding the electron to the atom. And that's why it's no longer a perturbative effect, which can be explained by the Taylor expansion. So when you go above 10 to the 12, then you're in this high intensity laser physics regime. So I'll also say that the laser intensity was once again broken during COVID times, and the Koreans have the lead right now, and they have now measured 10 to the 23 watts per square centimeter. So we are now 10 orders of magnitude above nonlinear into the high intensity regime. So this is what my whole talk's about. I will start with the linear, and at the end, I'll show you what high intensity laser physics is. So I used to not have Max Planck, and then people in Texas got mad at me giving Einstein too much credit for everything. So I've added Max Planck, which is good, because last week I was just at one of the Max Planck Institutes giving this talk. So, and I remembered that while I was, when he showed up. Anyway, so there's all kinds of linear interactions of light and matter. I picked the photoelectric effect for two reasons in this talk. One is that in the end for my PhD, I did a multi-photon version of this, so why not start with this one? But also, we in optics, even though probably in this institution, you talk about Einstein's general relativity or special relativity or even E equals MC squared, but what he won the Nobel Prize for was his optics thing, and that's the photoelectric effect, so why not use this one as my linear example? Now, you know, so I think because you're all physicists, you know that it was Maxwell that really showed us that light had to be an EM wave, right, if you solve Maxwell's equations. And so people were convinced, because the theory, obviously we use it to this day, was so strong. But I can also tell you, as an experimentalist, it's not true until we prove that it's true, so with an experiment. So at the end of the 19th century, this is when people were trying to do these photoelectric effect experiments, because they were trying to see the electrons come off in the very same way a stone would be kicked up a beach by a high water wave. And so we all know, just from watching stones on a beach, is that it has nothing to do with the distance between the crests, it has to do with the height of the wave that will push those stones up the beach. So they did the experiments, and of course, as we know, they found out that it seemed to go with the distance between the crests, or the frequency or wavelength, depending on how you look at it, more than it went with the amplitude, All right? And so this sort of flew in the face of light being a wave as known by Maxwell's wave equations. And so it was Albert Einstein using the fact that Max Planck had already figured out that the energy could not continuously change. There was this minimum energy unit that we'll call the photon. Now, I know that I upset my colleagues at the Institute of Quantum Computing also when I've given this talk earlier. Because they think I, you know, give too much credit again to this experiment showing the quantum mechanics of light. This does not show that it's a particle. It only shows that the energy of a photon, which is the minimum energy unit, if you don't want to call it anything else, but it's given by h nu. And there's nothing in Maxwell's classical equations that would give this h nu. All right, so we brought quantum mechanics into light, and it was Albert Einstein and Max Planck that did that for us. So usually when we teach this to our physics undergraduates, we are teaching the quantum mechanics of it. But for this talk, I really just want you to concentrate on the fact that it's a linear effect. And what I mean by that is that it's always one photon talking to one atom at a time. And what Albert Einstein showed was that if the photon energy, the h nu of the photon, was greater than the energy that the electron was sitting in, then the electron was ejected with the difference in energy, because energy is always conserved. So, and then if you turn up the power in this photon picture, you have more photons at play with more atoms, but it's still linear in that it's always this one photon with this one atom. So that's where we were at the beginning of the 20th century. And then along came this woman. She's famous for being the second woman to win a Nobel Prize, Maria Goeppert-Mayer. But, you know, that's work she did in the 50s at Argonne-Hessian Lab about nuclear shell model, which I know nothing about, so we won't discuss it. But what I am going to talk about is what she did when she was still a graduate student. Right? She was working with Max Born in Germany, and she was the one who asked the question, why can atoms only play with photons one at a time? Why can't atoms ever absorb the energy of two photons at once? All right? And so she's the one who showed it. I will also point out, let me point it out up here where you can see my laser pointer, she is a sole author of this paper. She worked on it in 1930, and the paper came out in 31. We still use for the photons these ones. I think we've quit using to say the electrons do this. But she showed that if you want two photon absorption, which you might see this nu and nu prime, they don't have to be the same frequency, you can get from level n to level m, but you have to have minimum three quantum states of the electron in order to have this two-photon process. So you could have two photons up, you could start up and have spontaneous photon down conversion. You could also have the difference frequency. This one makes more sense, that this arrow that maybe you might think the electron went up here and came down, and likewise you could start there. So she went through it all, and basically she had the second order term of the Taylor expansion, and she perturbatively put that into Maxwell's equations to get out this answer, and she showed theoretically, 1931, that it should happen. But nobody had seen it. This is what's remarkable, that she even thought to ask the question. It was 1961 before anybody saw it. Now you'll see that I called it multiphoton physics when she did it, and now I'm going to call it nonlinear optical interaction. It took me 30 years to know there was a difference, and so now I'm going to teach it to you. If you're an atomic or molecular physicist and you watch what happens to the atom or molecule, you are doing multiphoton physics. But if you're an optics person like me and watch what happens to the light, then you're doing nonlinear optics. It's a subtle difference. Okay? So the first thing that was observed, now the two-photon absorption that Maria Goeppert-Mayer talked about was also observed in 1961, but it came out a few months after this one. So this is the first one. And so this is what we call second harmonic generation. So they used quartz crystal. They had two red photons go in, and instead of being absorbed, they were just momentarily absorbed, and the energy did not go out as two red photons. It went out as one ultraviolet photon, twice the energy. So this is also part of the history of nonlinear optics that we all get to know. Again, so many of you are so young, you won't realize that we used to use actual film. Right? We did not have digital cameras, we used actual film. And so journals then had to have film editors, because we actually sent, like in my case, Polaroids to the journals, and they put them into the journal. But part of that was to clean up all the mess, because there's always dust, and that always leaves little specks. Now, it only occurred in 1 to a million, 1 to 10 million, and so they really, really had to saturate the film, okay? And even so, they thought the dot was so small, they better put an arrow to help you see it. Now you're all staring and you're not seeing it, and that's because the photo editor thought it also was a piece of dust. And so they removed the data that was there, but we all believe they saw it in 1961. So that was the first time we got to see this nonlinear interaction. And the question is, why did it take 30 years? I already told you at the beginning of the talk, it's the laser came along in 1960. So this is part of my Nobel talk, and I do want to pay homage to all the people that won the Nobel in this field ahead of me. Vassov and Prokhorov were working together in Russia. Townes was working independently in the United States. They all developed the maser. M stands for microwave, where L stands for light. Technologically, it was easier to make the maser. Actually, the lower the energy, the easier it is to make. We're still trying to get an X-ray laser to go. So they won the first Nobel in this area. Art Shallow won a few years later for laser spectroscopy, but he's one of the people credited with changing the technology so that it would work for light. But it's really this man who did not win the Nobel Prize. Ted Maiman in May 16, 1960 was the first one to figure out how to make a laser work. So first, what's so special about a laser? Obviously, I'm standing being blinded by these very bright lights. But these lights are mostly emitting spontaneously emitted photons, not completely, but mostly. And so this means that each atom's doing its own thing. It's emitting photons from whatever quantum state it wants to, and so we have photons of every color. Luckily, to light us all up, they go in all directions. Most importantly, they do not talk to each other. As opposed to the laser that I point with, and the fact that you can even see the green beam out of this 1 milliwatt laser is amazing when the lights are so bright. And that's because, of course, it's only one color, it's going in one direction, and most importantly, they're coherent, which means they talk to each other. When one peaks, the other peaks, and when the trough, they all trough. And so in this way, they can add and get to be a giant wave classically. So why do we need this in order to see nonlinear optics? Well, with linear optics, you then have these photons that are all coming out at different colors, which I like to say then they're all dancing to their own beat. And not only are they each dancing at their own beat, they don't care how the other one's dancing, which is why they simply cannot crowd onto the dance floor, okay? Now, we can try to force them to crowd a bit by using lenses, and you focus down, but we cannot focus to less than a wavelength of light, which is usually for lasers around 1 micron. And as we know, atoms are 10,000 times smaller in diameter. So if you look at the interaction volume of this atom, which is given by the cross-sectional scattering area of the atom, the third dimension is the interaction time, or given by the interaction time, times the speed of light. I think this is possibly why Mir-Goppert-Mayer chose to do two-photon absorption, because absorption is a resonant process, has the longest time, would have the biggest interaction volume. But nevertheless, with regular light, the chances of seeing more than one photon in that interaction volume was too small to be seen. But when the laser came along, now Nicholas Bloembergen won with Art Shallow, but he's considered to be the father of nonlinear optics, like Maria Goppert-Mayer is the mother of multiphoton physics, the parents of twins. And now with the laser, you see that they're all dancing to the same beat, and they're all dancing together to that same beat, and that's why they can crowd onto the dance floor. So in 1961, with a 1 joule laser, there was that chance that in that interaction volume, there would be two photons to simultaneously be absorbed. Okay. So, what has this got to do with me and my PhD? When I joined Gerard Mourou's group, he gave me this theoretical paper written by Stephen Harris at Stanford University. And Stephen was asking the question, you know, it's great that we have coherent lasers now. They're mostly in the near-infrared, there was CO2 further into the mid-infrared, dye lasers in the visible, a few other visible lasers. But wouldn't it be great if we could have this coherent radiation further into the UV, up into the XUV, possibly the X-rays, okay? And could we do it with not just, you know, two-photon, second harmonic generation, but high-order harmonic generation? Now, what I didn't talk about when I showed you Mir-Goppert-Mayer's work is that from a symmetry point of view, you cannot have, in a homogeneous isotropic medium, even order nonlinearities. So, but what you can do in this Taylor expansion is in this case here, this is using a 4-photon resonance, And so the first one in the Taylor expansion that will see that four-photon resonance that can happen is the fifth photon process. And so he actually showed four up and then one down, the same as what Maria Goldfried-Mayer showed, and four up and then one more up. These two use a six photon, six up, one down, one up. By the time he got to the 15th, you know, the point was to get out to the XUV, so why worry about going down? So that's the 14th photon resonance and one more to get 15. So Gerard said, is this something you want to work on? If so, figure out something to do that would work with our lasers. So I looked at it, decided it would be a fun project, and I came up with a scheme that twice ionized nickel would have an eight photon resonant of our neodymium YAG laser, and we would try to make the ninth harmonic. So there were two parts to my PhD. Figure out how to make a cold plasma of twice ionized nickel. It must be a cold plasma because you have to assume we start in the ground state of that twice ionized nickel. And get a high-intensity laser, because I didn't want to just absorb two photons. I needed nine photons in the interaction volume. One part of my thesis, as you know, is very successful. The other part didn't work at all. Okay, so I never did make twice ionized cold plasma of nickel, so let's not worry about that part anymore. So we'll go on. I'll tell you what I did do for my PhD at the end, but we're going to now just figure out how to build a high-intensity laser. So I was working at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics at the University of Rochester. This is a DOE-funded facility for laser fusion. Laser fusion is an application that requires energy in to get energy out. So this is a great big laser. This is a kilojoule laser. Just to give you a scale, this is like sitting on like a football-sized field. This thing here is the size of a human adult, okay? So it's a large laser, and I'll explain later why to get a kilojoule out you need a large laser. You can also imagine that a large laser is also an expensive laser, all right? The streaks that you're seeing is that they also realized in the 80s while I was there that fusion would happen with shorter wavelengths, and so they actually frequency tripled this light, not doubled, but tripled it very efficiently, and the UV is going along, and that's fluorescence of the air. I'll also tell you that there was a countdown every time this fired, and only fired a few times a day, and you had to not be in there. They were watching, but if you were, you had to hit the ground. So you weren't blinded or electrocuted. Okay. I was never in there. All right, so we had these big energy lasers, and in between Gerard's short pulse lasers, which for some reason is not on this talk, and this big energy laser, there was a laser called the glass development laser. It was one beam, basically the identical thing, that they would try all new things on one beam rather than the 24-beam omega system. And so in the 70s, they certainly tried to put short pulses down these big energy systems so they could have high peak power. And what they found was usually they were running 8 nanoseconds and getting this kilojoule out. This is saturation, don't worry about that. But as soon as you got past saturation, you'll see it goes down as a straight line, so it was power. If you had 100 picoseconds, you could get 100 joules. If you only had a picosecond pulse, even with that giant laser, you could only get the 1 joule out. And the question is why? Well, it turned out that nonlinear optics was happening in the laser rods. So a glass laser rod is isotropic and homogeneous, so a third order nonlinearity is the first one you're going to see. So the index of refraction comes from that susceptibility, the linear susceptibility being chi e, chi being the susceptibility. The next one would be e cubed. So if you pull the e out, and don't worry about the rest, you get the index of refraction from the chi term, and you get this term proportional to e squared, which is also then proportional to the intensity of the light. So now the index of refraction of your glass is no longer just dependent on the normal refractive index of the glass. It actually depends on the intensity. And so what does that mean? Well, you have a laser beam is always, you know, a Gaussian beam, which means it's more intense in the center than it is on the edges. And so the edges, which go to zero, still travel at the normal speed of light in glass, but where the intensity is high is traveling slower. So although we would send down plane waves into our amplifiers and hope they would stay a plane large beam, you actually started to curve that wavefront, which means you acted like a lens. And as soon as you do that, you've made the beam actually smaller, which means you've made the on-axis intensity even higher. So it happens faster, 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 until the beam just simply collapses in on itself right here, given by a self-focusing distance. The self-focusing distance is power dependent. If you turned up the overall power, the edges are still going to zero, but you have even more intensity on axis, so it happens faster. Now, I can tell you, because I caused this kind of damage in my own laser rods, that it does not look like just one blob of damage. If you can imagine this glass being made out of, like, maybe gelatin, and imagine a hypodermic needle going in and being pulled out, and imagine that track of damage, that's what our laser rods would look like if you let this happen. And so they had to think about that and wonder why it was a Lyme. It was these guys, Loy and Shen, who were at Berkeley, that figured this out. And so, again, we're trying to put short pulses in, so it's not just that you have this Gaussian beam in space, but you have this pulse in time. So I'm just going to divide it into five chunks. So, you know, this part here, A, is the most powerful, and so it has the shortest self-focusing distance. The B parts have lower power, so they focus here. First this one, and later on this one will come here and focus. And finally this one, from the low power, it would focus here. But of course, the power doesn't change in chunks. It changes continuously, and that's why you would see damage all the way from here back to here and then back out again. Okay, so when people saw this in the early 70s, two things happened. It made people like Loy and Shen, nonlinear optics people, think, why is it happening? And they investigated it. But laser jocks like me were told, don't put short pulses down our very expensive high-energy lasers because it causes very expensive damage. So that's where we were when I was working on this in the 80s. And so this is why we needed chirped pulse amplification. This is now George and my Nobel picture. You'll see we're in color. I used to say it was because we were present day, but we're also history. I just don't want to change it to black and white. Anyway, we're having a ball at the ball. So I like to say that I built a laser hammer, right? Like, fusion is an application that requires energy in, but nonlinear optics is like driving a nail into a piece of wood. You can push with all your might. It doesn't go in, but you pick up a hammer, it goes in. And so we want a laser hammer, which is a lot of energy in a short pulse of time. We do not want our laser hammer causing damage inside our amplifiers. So very simple. I think I have the simplest Nobel Prize in physics to explain. So we have a short pulse laser. We want to amplify it. So all we do is stretch it. I'm going to show you how, but we stretch it by chirping it, which is why it's not called stretched pulse amplification. We thought chirped pulse amplification sounded better. But it's just stretched pulse. You can safely amplify it. And then when you got all the energy, when safely out of the amplifier, you compress it and have the hammer. When I did it, we compressed in air. I will tell you now, I mean, certainly the people that are getting 10 to the 23, and actually by 10 to the 12, air is a nonlinear medium. And so it's all done in vacuum at that point. That's it. That's the whole thing. All right, so the neodymium YAG laser is this one back here. It's an infrared laser. That's why you don't see any beam here. This laser was used. This is the Girard's actually 100 femtosecond laser pulse. It's a dye laser. So I was talking to some people earlier about getting blasted by dye. Anyway, this is dye that would, you know, dye your, if it sprayed on you, it would dye your clothes orange. And this is an infrared light. This is a frequency doubler. The same thing that in 1961 they were able to do one part in a million to 10 million, we now have the intensity high enough that it's 10% efficient. It's a 2-watt laser. This is 200 milliwatts of green. Our laser mirrors are very good for the color they're supposed to be very good for. So 99.99% of that green is turning the corner. But all the infrared is going right on through that mirror. And so almost 2 watts just went into a beam dump because you didn't want that 2 watts landing on us. Okay, so you'll also see that this is the laser I'm going to use, but there's really no room left for me here to do anything. But here I am in 1984 starting the project. This is for the cover of the Quarterly Review of LLE. They always put a student on the Quarterly Review. I'll tell you a few things about this picture. One, we want to show that we're always laser safe. So I have my lovely 1980s goggles on. You'll see that. But the photographer did not like the green glass covering my eyes. So actually, I'm only wearing frames. He took the glass out. Now, it's OK because an infrared laser, you can't tell if it's on or off anyway. And so it's off, and I'm safe. He also wanted me to actually touch a knob. I went, you are crazy, no. takes too long to tweak this stuff. So I just have my hands up there like I am touching something, but I'm not. All right? So this is where the beam dump used to be, and the light goes in here. And here's my pulse stretcher. And it's 1.4 kilometers of fiber. It had to do three things. The YAG laser is 150 picoseconds, and I want to get down closer to 1 picosecond, so I need to make more bandwidth. I'm not going to explain that in this talk, because I only have 30 minutes. So I need a nonlinear optics happening in the fiber. And then once I made to make all these colors, and once I have all the colors, I can use this dispersion in this 1.4 kilometers of fiber. Now, usually I'm going to tell you the story, even though you're theorists, but it's usually for the experimental grad students I tell the story. I was asked when I was giving this talk in Toronto, and this young woman asked me why 1.4 kilometers. And I, you know, she was disappointed in the answer, I could tell. I think she thought I won a Nobel Prize. I should have really had to do some serious calculations for this project. But I did not have to calculate the length of this fiber. So once we decided that, once Gerard decided he wanted this done, and he wanted it done now, I will tell you the laser amplifier I used was from his PhD. He phoned over to France and said, "Do you still have that old laser? Send it over. We're doing this project now." Corning is just an hour south of Rochester. It is a big glass company, and certainly it was big in fiber optics. They had a new fiber that worked for 1 micron, which is the wavelength for YAG. It was a specialty fiber. Another word for specialty fiber is expensive fiber. So, and we had no budget. We did not write a grant and try to get, you know, no. Sure, I want it done. He wanted it done now. So he called and he said, "This is going to be a very important research project. Don't you want to be part of it? Don't you want to donate fiber?" They very nicely donated 2.5 kilometers of fiber, which was great. Now, most people, I guess, that want 2.5 kilometers of fiber want to lay it across 2.5 kilometers. So they only had one end showing, but I had to get to both ends. So I had to spend a day of my life unspooling and respooling. But we only had one spool. So we had to use, and again, you're too young to even know what these are, but we had a film canister that we had to put corks around, and I spent a day doing this. And then I put the light in it, and it didn't come out. And so this is the way Murphy's Law is, right? So I picked up my IR viewer, and sure enough, it was coming out, and it was coming out almost in the middle. Luckily, I'd only broken it one place, but I had broken it almost in the middle, and the bigger of the two ends was 1.4 kilometers. So that's why I used 1.4 kilometers, okay? I'll show you in a bit that wasn't really long enough, which is why I damaged a few rods. But anyway, let's go on. Okay, so we've had a lot of talks about using telescopes and using Fourier in their space versus angular frequency. It's true in the short pulses. If you want, usually when we talk about lasers to start with, we say they're single color. They don't have to be single color. You can have many transitions that they can, so you can have all of these colors. But instead, we still want all of the colors talking with each other. So we put something in our laser called a mode locker. So a mode locker is like a conductor in an orchestra. So when you go and hear an orchestra and you hear them, at first they're warming up their own instruments and tuning their own instruments, they sound awful because they're all just playing their own notes at their own time. But when the conductor brings down his baton and they all play their different notes, it sounds beautiful. And so that's what we have in our laser. It's a mode locker, and it says, "Go now. At this point in space and time, all of you peak." Now, because, of course, then all the different wavelengths, as you go away from there, then you have peaks and troughs, and that's how you get a short pulse. And the wider the bandwidth, the quicker this happens. The black is the addition of all those colors, and you will notice that the distance between the crests of this is now equidistant, so it looks like it's a single color, but it's this short pulse thing. This is what we call a Fourier transform limited pulse. Ideally, in the ultrafast world, this is what we all want. We almost never get it, but that's beside the point. This is what we want. Okay, that's the shortest pulse you can have for the bandwidth that you have. Okay, so once we have a lot of bandwidth, then we can talk about dispersion and what it is. So instead of dividing the time, I divide it in 5, but I stole this picture from the web. They've divided it into 3. So there's, you know, the reddest of the colors will travel fastest through fiber, then the green, and then the bluer colors. And so if you look in time, you start red, you end up green, and then you have blue. And so this is how we do the stretching of the pulse, is that in the 1.4 kilometers of fiber, we managed to get 350 picosecond long pulse. We wanted a nanosecond, so even the 2.5 kilometers wouldn't have quite got us there. So, you know, it's okay. All right, so now all that's left is that we have to amplify. I'm just gonna tell you quickly, why did we do it right then, right now, why it had to be quick? 1984, which is when I started this project, we'd gone to the big laser conference, CLIO, and the ultrafast optics conference, and everybody was doing fiber optic pulse compression of neodymium YAG lasers. And they were showing that if you wanted to do it really well and get as close to this linear chirp as you could, which we knew how to compress, you had to actually go much longer fiber than just what you needed to make the colors. And so as soon as we all saw that, Girard already had the idea, sort of in general, for chirp-to-pulse amplification, although he probably wasn't called that, because he didn't know how he was going to do it, but he knew he had to lengthen the pulse. Right then we knew, okay, all we have to do is stick the amplifier after the fiber before the compressor, we're good to go. All right, so now you're going to be surprised that this is, even for when I'm at a laser conference, this is how complicated I explain the lasers. So you're going to see these are just atoms, because they're boring, and I'm an optical person, not an atomic person. That's what I like to say. Only my photons have personality. So here we go. You have to excite them somehow. We used a lamp for our case. If you engineer well, you get most of them in an excited state. So we already had dye lasers that were shorter pulses than what I'm talking about, but dye lasers were this high gain material, much more like a light bulb if you try to make it big, because it does not want to stay in the excited state. It wants to let it decay, it wants to let a photon go, and they would start going, and you would have gain in all directions. It would just be like a light bulb. That's why you cannot have a big energy system out of dye. On the other hand, the big fusion laser that I showed you, made out of neodymium glass, has one of the highest storage energy for lasers. It'll hang on and sit here until a photon comes along. Okay, so there's my photon. And the photon now sees it's got the very same energy as the atom, and so it says, hey, I can take the energy and two photons will walk hand in hand. It will also say, because it's not as well known as Einstein's other things, Einstein gave us the three equations that we used to develop a laser back in 1917. He's the one that showed us that stimulated emission was the same thing as absorption in reverse. There we go. Those two photons walk hand in hand, meet two more atoms. They become four, four become eight. All lasers begin with this one noise photon going in the right direction. This is exponential growth. It all starts that way, but you'll notice that if you're in the exponential growth regime, you've left most of your energy behind, and you don't want to do that. This is one of the reasons that lasers must have a cavity and send the beam back and forth and back and forth. But as I said, glass is something that will store a lot of energy. Each lasing material has what's known as its saturation energy flux. That's the energy per unit area that you have to get to so that it acts more like a snowplow. See how this works in Canada? Snowplow, and it just takes all of that energy away in a linear fashion. So this is why the lasers will start out quite small, will focus quite tight, because we have to start with that one photon and start going and getting it up there. If you want to get more energy after the laser, you blow the beam up a bit bigger till it's five joules per square centimeter, you amplify it, you take that energy, you make the beam bigger, back to 5 joules per square centimeter into the next amplifier. This is why the kilojoule laser had to be so large, because it's 5 joules per square centimeter and they're trying to get to a kilojoule. So this is why you need big lasers if you want big amplification. Now, on the other hand, we don't want our laser hammer inside the laser. That is a photon density. It's a nonlinear optics effect, so that's photon density, as I explained before. And so once you know what energy per unit area you're going to use for whichever laser you're using, you also then know its nonlinear optical coefficient. That tells you what photon density you must be kept below. And that's why for glass, we wanted a nanosecond. It's the one time American units really work for you. A nanosecond is exactly a foot, okay? So it's a foot long pulse of light that has to go down your laser. So the only thing left then is to compress it. This was already known in 1969. This is why we knew we wanted a linear chirp if at all possible. Instead of using prisms that we all know bend light differently for different colors, gratings do it more strongly than prisms do. And so if you watch, we have the red out ahead of the green, out ahead of the blue, and the red will bend more than the green and more than the blue. And so when they come off the second grating that is kept parallel, they all come off parallel, but now they're all put back as a short pulse. Now, if any of you are laser people, you'll see that it was actually a line and not a spot. so that's no good either. We actually have the gradients half that distance with a mirror sending it back. And so we have a round dot and a short pulse. And that's it. That's all there was to it. One Thursday night, a colleague of mine, Steve Williamson, luckily had just bought a new street camera because I had no way to measure if my amplified pulses were short. And he wheeled a street camera into my lab. And this is an Edelon to calibrate it. But it showed that we had 2 picosecond pulses amplified up. And that's it. So I'm back to the beginning of my talk. I already told you, can't do harmonic generation. I will also say, not only could I not figure out twice ionized nickel, but by the time I got to the end of my PhD, the French group had seen the 31st harmonic, so why even bother trying to do the 9th? So my PhD was blown out so many ways. I was lucky that Silong Chen had heard about our CPA laser. He wanted to be the first to use it. He wanted to study multiphoton ionization. So he came down for a sabbatical and worked with us on this. So I told you the difference between nonlinear optics and high-intensity laser physics is the breaking down of the Taylor expansion, but I'm an experimentalist, so I want to give you a conceptual way of understanding this. So he was trying to figure out, is it this multiphoton regime, or is it something new, either tunneling or over the barrier? So again, the way to think about light interacting with matter is if you could imagine it just, you know, instead of the Coulomb potential that's sort of drawn there, just picture a bowl and a ball inside this bowl, and that'll be your electron. And when the light comes along, it shakes the bowl. And so then the ball can move in the bowl. Now, regular light can barely move it, and so the ball barely moves. As you turn up the power and you start to see nonlinear optics, it moves enough. So it's the same as pushing a child on a swing the first time. Child doesn't go very far. The next time you push it, it goes bigger, bigger, bigger. And so you can imagine this perturbative way that eventually the ball goes back and forth, and comes out of the bowl. But keep imagining as the intensity gets higher, we had gotten to the point where we had just turned the bowl upside down, and the electron came out. So that's my laser hammer. The light comes in, it's nothing to do with absorbing. It comes in there and hammers those electrons right off the atoms, okay? And so this is the new regime. My PhD actually showed that it was classical over the barrier model. I will also tell the theorists in the room that we did this in the last 6 months of my PhD, and I had not studied multiphoton ionization at all. I had not studied the tunnel ionization, which is also shown here, and most of the time it's tunnel ionization now. And our experiments didn't match anybody's results. Certainly didn't match the multiphoton. We knew we weren't in that regime. But it didn't match the others that looked more like this tunneling regime. And we were at a loss. So anyways, I went off to do my postdoc. And the one guy working said, you know, well, which do you want to write up? Which, you know, I said, I'm out of here. You write it up, but if you use my data, put my name on the paper. Anyway, they sent it off. And it was the reviewer of the paper that came back and drew the figure for us that showed it was classical over the barrier model. Now, it turned out, I didn't know it at the time, but it was my friend Phil Buxbaum who gave that result, and he's not author on this paper. Now, I saw the student who got to be first author on this paper when I was at, he's now at Lincoln Labs, and I told the story, and he said, we asked Phil, and Phil didn't want to be named on the paper. I thought, well, that's pretty nice, because he actually said what it was, he drew the figure to show us that it was, and he still didn't put his name on the paper. So I kind of like to let people know now, Phil Buxbaum was the one who figured out my PhD work. Anyway, so this is what happened, okay? And so this is why we now can machine glass. I'm not going to show you the movies of the machining of the glass, but this is why now we don't have to worry about absorption. We don't have to cut from the edge on down, like if you're cutting steel with lasers, regular lasers. And so we can actually, this is what we do mostly with this laser, is cut the corneal flap, and you can keep the beam still big at the edge so you don't cause any problem. You focus inside and raster scan, and this is how we do laser surgery on clear objects. It's also why the glass parts in your cell phone are cut with this laser. All right, so this is a photo, this is where I'm gonna end here, that Gerard has been showing for a number of years about how over time we've changed the intensity. So we start with the laser, okay, because that was a dramatic pickup. And then these are two techniques to make the pulse short. This is where I said we were stuck, that we could not amplify the short pulses. We came along in 1985. It took 10 years before one of these kilojoule lasers would do this. It took Gerard 5 years of just begging every place that had a big laser to do it. Everybody was, I think, scared to put this inside their big laser and burn it. At 5 years, we finally got people to do it. It took 5 years, and the problem was the gratings at the end. The laser does 5 joules per square centimeter. The grating I used had a damage threshold of 50 millijoules per square centimeter, and the gratings must be perfectly cut for the whole time. So Livermore spent 5 years. They got it up to 1 joule per square centimeter damage, and they were able to figure out how to make meter size gratings. This is also probably going to be what limits us going forward. So I will just tell you that up here now, since COVID, this blue one is the European laser. It's got the highest power now at 10 petawatts, so basically a kilojoule in 100 femtoseconds. But it's Korea. This is blue because there's no measured intensity, so we don't know that. This one was measured in the past year in Korea. It's 10 to the 23. They do focus down to single wavelength dimension. So I don't know how to, like, this graph was made for me, so I don't know how to make this white line roll over more. But you can see that we have rolled over again. So I do point this out not to you theory students, but when I'm at a laser place, it's time for a new Nobel Prize winning idea to kick us on up again. Most of the work commercially is done down here. I will tell you that Gerard has this way up here. This is where, if we can get to 10 to the 29 watts per square centimeter, we can focus into vacuum and make matter. The positrons and electrons should come on out. Now, high energy people might wonder why you care. And the one that I've heard that I really like, Gert Lukes of the Max Planck for Light, has said, he came a few years ago to Waterloo and gave this great talk, what's epsilon naught? We all use epsilon naught. Epsilon naught is part, Y is CC, right? It's the square root of the inverse of epsilon naught, mu naught. But nobody knows what the heck it is. Once you go past that and go into material, you're talking about the refractive index. It is just the polarization. So it's epsilon naught, the polarization of your electrons and positrons in the vacuum. And if we blow them up, can we change the speed of light? That's what we're still waiting to see. But we'll leave it for that. And there we go. I've changed which one I show. I used to show me just smiling like crazy to say that's what I did for my PhD that landed me beside the King of Sweden. But then I saw this picture. I went, doesn't it look like I'm explaining the photoelectric effect to him? I don't think I talk science to him, so I have no idea what I'm saying to him. But at least he's listening. Anyway, thank you very much.
Beautiful talk, so I got distracted with time. We are a little bit over, but it's fine.
Oh, am I? Sorry. Did you give me the 5-minute warning?
We have time for one question. Okay, I'll throw it.
Oh my God, that's quite a throw.
There you go.
Halfway there anyway, more than. You're right, there we go.
Okay, hi. Earlier, Sir Anthony told us that 50% of his greatest ideas came while he was teaching. And I was wondering if you feel the same way, that the majority or a part of your ideas came through teaching, or if not, when did they come?
I think they come quite often from conversations with other people. But also, I think there are times when, if I get frustrated, what I do is go for a walk. I really love walking, and I just calm down walking. So I think that's another time. But it's either when you're having conversations, but it's true. If you're talking about teaching, when I teach my grad course, then things come up. If I was given to talk about what I do now, there's been things that I came along after teaching the nonlinear optics course that made me understand what I'm doing in the lab.
Okay, thank you.
Is it work? Sorry, here. Yeah, just wondering if we can go further than the Schwinger effect bound, like after this point, can we increase the power, or is it an upper bound?
Well, I think that the problem, I think, once the power you can go up, because it's only where you focus where you're at 10 to the 29, right. But if you're wondering, can you get above that? Mm-hmm. I would think you start it would look like a black thing once you're starting to have positrons and electrons absorbing the light, you would get that absorption, and so it would be hard to go through.
Right.
But I don't know, because we haven't done it.
Okay.
And we're 6 orders of magnitude away, so I'm hoping to still be alive when we can. It won't be by me.